Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, talknation.org, for transcripts and discussion of this half-hour program. Our topic this time is the continuing fallout from Ann Coulter's visit to the campus of the University of Connecticut in Storrs, where she faced loud critics and frequent heckling. The event has led to continued bashing on Fox Network, where Bill O'Reilly has called the hecklers Nazis and said they should have been arrested. Throughout the Christmas holiday week, Bill O'Reilly continued to slam UConn students and at one point showed film of young people standing outside of the auditorium where Coulter was speaking. There were no arrests made when Coulter visited UConn December 7th, and while some reports said she left after 15 minutes, in fact, Coulter stayed at the auditorium to take questions from students and others for over an hour. At no time was she prevented from speaking, though she did face loud and frequent roars of disapproval. Today, part two of a discussion with Chip Berlay, a senior researcher at Political Research Associates in Massachusetts. Last week, Berlay said those who invited Coulter to campus had not done their homework to learn more about who she is and the kinds of things she says.
I don't think that when you invite Ann Coulter to campus, you should expect to have a serious raising of the issues. And I have to say, forgive me, but whoever brought her to campus didn't do their homework. It would be like, you know, bringing David Duke to campus to talk about race relations. It's an absurdity.
Chip Berlay has done extensive research into the divisive politics of the right wing in America. Since much of his work involves public education services, he has agreed to offer the first 50 people who write in to him at pra@publiceye.org a free copy of PRA's most recent report called Deliberate Differences, Progressive and Conservative Campus Activism. All you have to do to receive the report for free is to write to PRA and say that you heard about the program through Talk Nation Radio, produced at WHUS. We begin our program again with another short review of some of the things Ann Coulter has had to say. Our audio was taken from the website MediaMatters.org. In recent commentary on the NSA spying on Americans authorized by George Bush, Ann Coulter called the NSA no such agency and then said, quote, "I have difficulty giving up much interest in this story, inasmuch as I think the government should be spying on all Arabs, engaging in torture as a televised spectator sport, dropping daisy cutters wantonly throughout the Middle East, and sending liberals to Guantanamo." That was quoting Ann Coulter. At the December 7th event at UConn, a student asked Ann Coulter whether or not she had really said America should invade Arab countries, kill their leaders, and convert their populations to Christianity. Next, you will hear her defend that remark in audio again from MediaMatters.org. The remarks were made on Fox.
I've been asked, by the way, if you want to reiterate that statement when you said right after September 11th, you said, and you know where I'm going with this, I'm often asked if I still think we should invade their countries, kill their leaders, convert them to Christianity. You say the same thing Nixon said in 1972. Now more than ever.
Now more than ever.
So you want to invade their countries? You want to carpet bomb the Mideast?
No. We've already...
But we should all... They should all become Christians, right?
By Friday of 9/11, we had accomplished point one and point two.
Invade their countries, kill their leaders. We'll pick this up when we get back. Would you like to convert these people all to Christianity?
The ones that we haven't killed, yes.
And so no one should be Muslim. They should all be Christian.
That would be a good start, yeah.
Ann Coulter's racist remarks on Fox's Hannity and Combs, the O'Reilly Factor, and other networks, too, have brought unwelcome attention from media watch groups. Rather than discuss this criticism, Coulter and other commentators on Fox merely say it's part of a smear campaign against them. But as I discussed the December 7th UConn event with Chip Berlay, I pointed out to him that the Coulter supporters I had spoken with tended to say they supported everything she said. Some said she was their role model. Others said they liked the fact that she was against abortion, against bringing troops home from Iraq, and most seemed to write off any of the more mean-spirited remarks she had made as a joke. We pick up our discussion where I'm asking Chip Berlay why none of the Coulter supporters appeared to be able to recall anything she had said at UConn.
Well, when you have a person who specializes in contentless rhetoric, what you're going to leave behind is an emotional sense of well-being and satisfaction, which can't be tracked back to a specific intellectual point. Anyway, people talk about demagogues. It's a word that's fallen out of favor, but a demagogue is someone who can speak for an hour, keep a crowd completely mesmerized, and as they leave, enraptured by the amazing rhetorical ability of the demagogue, and if you would ask them, well, what did they promise, what did they suggest, what's the action plan, what was the intellectual message, they really have no memory of that because there is no memory to be had. When you simply string together cliches and nasty attacks, what would you remember other than the sense of, we're right, they're wrong, we should crush them, and isn't she wonderful? It's a form of demagoguery, and it's wrong whether it's done on the left or the right or the middle. I mean, the kind of contentless rhetoric that I'm talking about is unfortunately seeping into the political styles of both the Democratic and the Republican Party. There's been a real move away from issues and away towards framing without attention to ideology or content. And framing is very important in packaging ideas, but framing without ideas is very, very dangerous. It is a form of demagoguery, and it has very bad track record in terms of political history.
One of the things that people did seem to hone in on when asked again and again, I couldn't get over how often people didn't remember a word Ann Coulter said, but they did seem to know she was against abortion. That rang home with them, and that she was against bringing U.S. troops home from Iraq. So those were the two things that were always said. No one ever said anything else about what she had just said when they were supportive of her, So my question to you is about the issues themselves and how maybe you can describe for our listeners how an issue like abortion or now more recently the Iraq war get pounded down into a kind of nice little package so that you don't need to talk about the details. You don't have to be an expert. You can be for or against, the same way you can use the words liberal and right.
It's a dilemma that we as a society face, that with television and the internet and print advertising, there is a way that you can approach reality that is basically emotional and slogan-based and framed in a way that produces an affect. It really tracks back to Irving Goffman, who talks about framing as it's developed in sociology. It's a way of packaging ideas so that people basically structure the way they see an issue, and it becomes a kind of a hot button. And so you don't really have to go into details because the frame has been established. And the frame for conservative students on campus is that they're a beleaguered minority. And another frame of conservatives in general is that liberals are, traitors. Now, when I talk about a conservative frame in that sense, I don't mean actual conservatives. I mean the conservative movement, the right-wing movement in America has a set of frames. So if you actually ask average conservatives about what they think, you're not going to get the same effect. But in terms of a social movement developing frames, the frames of the conservative right are liberals are traitors, they're soft on terrorism, they're soft on crime, they're murderers, if you believe in the abortion issue, they're murderers of fetuses. And so you get a series of frames about traitors, people who don't care about the death of innocent children, and they're actually related because there's this sense of building a frame in which liberals don't care about quote-unquote unborn children, and they don't care about standing up against terror, and what's missing here is a moral center, and so liberals are amoral or immoral, and they don't understand the real threat of dangerous people, and they're too squeamish to really drop the hammer both domestically and in terms of foreign policy, and therefore they're a threat to the country. This is a very effective frame to portray someone as weak-willed and uncaring and indifferent to death and all these things. It's a very powerful emotional package, and so once you've established that frame, it's a little bit like telling the punchline of a joke. So if everyone's heard a joke 100 times, and you're sitting around, you can just tell the punchline, everyone laughs. Now, why is that? Well, they know the story. They already know the joke. They know how it builds up. And all you have to do is say the punchline, and everyone remembers the whole story. Now, of course, in real life, stories change all the time. Situations change. History moves forward. Things are complex. But if your discourse is telling the punchline of the joke over and over again, there's no examination of whether or not the story has changed. Has the joke changed? Is this the proper punchline anymore? Is this the punchline for the wrong joke? So frames without content analysis are really not useful in building democratic society. And so when I talk about framing, if a frame is built on an ideology with content, that's legitimate. If a frame exists as a floating apex, it's just the frame alone with no analytical rigidity and no analytical framework whatsoever, and is just basically used to hit the hot button, that's not democracy. A democracy is based on informed consent, not manipulated consent. And it's certainly not based on laughing at the punchline without considering, you know, the facts of the case.
Let's talk about that as it might relate to an issue, another issue that would be more uniting rather than dividing. Let's say the unfortunate response that U.S. authorities had when Hurricane Katrina hit. We saw a lot more unity in America, a lot more agreement that, hey, at moments like this, it really matters more what somebody knows than what he's wearing and how well he can identify with the issues, you know, in terms of saying quick, punchy things on TV. We saw Michael Brown really screw up, didn't we?
And
you know, I mean, Michael Brown, who might have been a roaring success if all that had ever been asked of him was to sit around looking well-dressed and performing like he was comfortable on TV.
Well, sure. Words like entitlement and privilege have to come into play here. And you know, this is my political bias. I think the rise of libertarianism, which I just don't happen to agree with, but I think the kind of libertarianism and the kind of transfer of wealth we've seen, these are two separate things that are going on, but they're related. You have people who are in positions of high social status and relatively, you know, successful in terms of their economic wealth and well-being, and they simply seem incapable of understanding how a person who doesn't have entitlement and privilege and wealth is supposed to deal with things. So that, you know, when somebody says evacuate New Orleans, they're assuming that you have a car. They're certainly not assuming that public transportation is going to do it because they haven't taken public transportation in years. They don't understand that somebody might have an elderly relative and not have the money to pay to have them transported by ambulance. There is a kind of outlandish sense of entitlement and privilege and the noblesse oblige of wealth in which people living day-to-day lives from paycheck to paycheck, their reality is simply not understood at all. And I think that very much when conservatives like Ann Coulter attack liberals for social programs and worrying about the poor, there's two things going on. There's this incredible sense of privilege and entitlement that makes the real day-to-day struggles of average people invisible. But there's also a kind of, you know, neo-Calvinist idea that if people are poor, they must have done something wrong. That if people can't find a job, it's because they're lazy. If people can't manage to follow the orders of their government in a crisis, it's because, you know, they're not listening or they're not obedient. And the possibility that someone just can't do it or just can't make it or is not in a position to act the way that they're expected to act, or that there are structural or economic reasons for their poverty or their inability to find a job. This is not even on the radar for these people, and for some reason, these kinds of people are currently running the country. And it's a combination of libertarian elitism and Calvinist punishment. And I don't know, but I think, you know, if my country is in a cross between libertarian elitism and Calvinist punishment, it's a pretty scary moment for many Americans.
Now, finally, Chip Brulé, let's talk about the war and the militancy in general of the Bush administration that we've really seen since 2000. A lot of it being legitimized always by 9/11. But a lot of Americans are tired of the mantra of 9/11 to justify so many things that they see now as clearly failed policies. We've seen the U.S. military in Iraq engage in brutal policies, some of which they're being called to task for now. So we've seen some success by people like John McCain at rehumanizing the discussion on torture, for example. And people are taking a closer look at Iraq and trying to say, well, what on earth did we go there for if Iraq did not have weapons of mass destruction? And to what extent did these people know that in advance? What does that say about their decision-making when it comes to their militancy? Because they went ahead and attacked and told us all those things about shock and awe and committed shock and awe. What does that say about them in terms of their militancy?
Matthew Rothschild of the Progressive has come up with the term messianic militarism to describe the Bush administration's kind of war on terror and invasion of countries in the Middle East. And I guess it's very apt. What we have in the Bush administration with its war policies is a cross between the apocalyptic millennialism of the Christian right and the kind of dogmatic imperial elitism of the neoconservative. Now, these are two very different groups in American society, but they both agree on a common plan in which America gets to export its idea of democracy and its idea of its own self-interest at the point of a gun. And it is apocalyptic in a secular sense for the neoconservatives, who think that there's a crisis of civilization and basically they've adopted the Huntington thesis about, you know, the Western cultures being under attack, which, incidentally, Amitai Etzioni just took apart in an essay in a sociology journal and warned that it was just flagrantly divisive and kind of out of control form of stereotyping. And he's a centrist, head of the communitarian movement to a large extent. But what you have then is this religious apocalyptic of the Christian right, especially Christian Zionism, where they simply are taking their view of a dualistic end times battle between good and evil and extrapolating that into U.S. foreign policy. Well, this is scary stuff. And it also means that because it's raised the issue of current U.S. foreign policy and military adventures to a cosmological level, both secular and religious, it means that if you oppose what they're doing, you're the enemy. And I think that that's a serious issue. And I just want to remind people that during the Vietnam War, there is no evidence that people on the left spat on soldiers. It's one of the great myths coming out of the Vietnam War that most of the people who are activists in the anti-war movement were very sympathetic to the fact of who was really doing the fighting in Vietnam and the resources that they had and the way that the military served as either an inescapable draft or a form of bootstrapping oneself up the economic ladder. So let's think for a moment about what it means when our government and two major sectors of the political right have an ideology in which any opposition to what they're doing is seen not just as misguided, but makes us in league with the enemy. It's a very, very bad situation that we have, both in terms of what motivates the kind of apocalyptic motivation of the neoconservatives and the Christian right. But it also means that we can't have a serious conversation about whether the war is a good idea or how is it going or what should we be doing, because in the Ann Coulter, Bill O'Reilly, David Horowitz scheme of things, any criticism of what's going on is tantamount to being a traitor, and in their most wild kind of rhetoric makes us essentially in favor of kind of Nazis. So we're the Nazis against the heroic people who are saving the world from terror. And, of course, it's kind of just a bizarre kind of rhetorical flourish. But I'd like to remember the folks that during the Vietnam War were willing to sit and listen and talk, and the returning veterans who played a major role in saying, we fought over there, but now we really think that what's going on there is not going to have a good ending, and we're not being told the truth, which is certainly what the Pentagon Papers showed us. So there are tremendous kinds of similarities between what's going on in terms of the war in Iraq and the war on terror in general, and the kind of unfolding distrust of the government and distrust of the plans and the claims that occurred during the Vietnam War. And there's no reason we need to treat people we disagree with as the enemy, no matter what position they take. I was an anti-war activist. I did civil disobedience, spent a few days in jail. My brother fought in Vietnam at the same time, and we're friends today. We were friends then. I understood what he felt he had to do, and he understood what I felt I had to do. And I think we're very able as a society to have different positions on a war that's ongoing without one side calling the other side traitors.
Now, much as the president has argued that anti-war activists are lagging in numbers in America, in fact, they seem to be growing in numbers in spite of any effort to sort of group everyone together in this nasty net that can be readily identified as liberal, and that means all of those things that are so often criticized in media, like you support abortion, you support gay marriage, you support just on and on and on the list. If you stand there with a peace button on, protesting the war in Iraq, those are all the isms that someone who doesn't understand America very well might put around you, okay? If you stand there with a sign that says, don't evict Katrina victims, hey, anything could be part of your profile, who really knows? And that's, I think, an interesting way of looking at it.
Well, I think it's important to understand that these kinds of issues are coalition issues, and you really can't make assumptions along different lines. One of the things I always tell people is that I have no problem on Tuesday picketing the Christian Coalition or some Christian right group against its stand on gay rights, and on Wednesday standing in line with them protesting some kind of race hate act. You have to understand that people are complicated, issues are complicated, and stereotyping politics in the U.S. as that abortion is a liberal issue and the war is a conservative issue, reproductive rights is a liberal issue, and the war on terrorism is a conservative issue, it's not true. I mean, I know a lot of people who think that, for instance, abortion is a sin, but they're conservative in a true sense of the word, and they would never imagine passing a law against it because of their conservative instincts, so that they have no problem proselytizing to you from a religious point of view, but they would never step over that boundary separating church and state and say, but I should therefore take my religious view and pass it as a law. So there, I know a number of Baptists who think along those lines. They're very horrified by attempts to make legislatively happen what should be happening through, you know, their religious convictions and their religious efforts. Same thing with anti-war people. I know a bunch of anti-war people who are folks who are in the military. They want a commander-in-chief who knows what they're doing, and they're reluctant to say that that's what's happening. And it's a fine line because, you know, there's a chain of command, but there's a lot of military people who are very suspicious of where we've stretched ourselves. And then there's a lot of working-class people whose family members are in Iraq, and they're very angry because they had what they thought was a set of contracts about their military service, whether it was in reserve or active duty or National Guard, and they think that they've been lied to, and they think that those contracts have been broken, and they have legitimate grievances, and it's hardly a progressive issue or a liberal issue. It's an issue of people who feel that they entered into a contract regarding military service, and that contract has been essentially brushed aside by an administration that isn't paying attention to what's going on. So don't make assumptions. Don't think that all conservatives are like Ann Coulter or Bill O'Reilly or David Horowitz. And conservatives don't think all liberals think the same way or all progressives think the same way.
Well, Chip Berlay, we've seen some, again, recent successes. In some cases, the right or conservatives in the country got together with liberals, who are complicated people, let me just add, not simple cardboard cutouts, but got together with those people. And for some reason, they were able to stop the progress of the Patriot Act this time. Interesting, interesting development and an interesting way of looking at how politics are changing. We can sometimes, when we're anxious about our country and where things are headed, get into a problem kind of thinking where we're so worried and fearful about global warming and the war and so many social problems that we have a sort of panic disorder when it comes to the possibility of, you know, of hope. But there is hope, isn't there?
Well, I think there is, and I'm certainly one of those people who's in that weird coalition. I'm on the board of the National Committee Against Repressive Legislation, and I work with folks with the ACLU and the National Lawyers Guild, and I know that the coalition that's been worried about the Patriot Act includes everyone from radical leftists to Grover Norquist and Paul Weyrich on the right wing. So you can put together, when it comes to electoral and legislative politics, the kinds of coalitions you build on a tactical level can be pretty broad, as long as you're willing to, you know, not give up your principles, but understand that a short-term goal can be worked towards by a variety of people, even when you're still critical of those people for issues of race, class, and gender. So, you know, people need to be sophisticated folks who have agency and have an understanding of the kind of humorous nature of coalition building when you're doing electoral or legislative work.
Sounds remarkably like democracy to me.
Yeah, it's messy, but it's a pretty good idea.
Chip Berlet, thanks so much for joining us to help us understand these complicated matters.
You bet.
Chip Berlet is co-author of the award-winning book, Right-Wing Populism in America, Too Close for Comfort. PRA is an independent, nonprofit research center that studies anti-democratic, authoritarian, and racist right-wing movements and trends in America. You can write to them at pra@publiceye.org for their report on campus debate. The report is free to the first 50 people who mention the call letters for the station where Talk Nation Radio is produced. That's WHUS in Storrs, Connecticut. As we assess some of the meaner comments from Ann Coulter and others on Fox, we should ask ourselves where such statements may be leading, or where some very extremist groups in America might take them as encouragement. In one strange development, Fox Network wound up airing a kind of promotion for a white supremacist group called Stormfront. For listeners who may be unfamiliar with the controversy and with some of the more extreme content that has been aired on Fox Network, let's turn to audio acquired by Think Progress, where an announcer on Fox interviews members of Stormfront, the group espousing white supremacy.
Fox Carolina's Tammy Berkner takes us inside the cyber world of Stormfront.
It's the only game in town.
It's a website with everything from dating advice and homemaking threads to discussion boards that focus on news that white activists want to know. Stormfront.org, a website founded on the belief that the white race is a dying race.
We really are just white folks that deeply care about preserving a future for our progeny.
There are more than 65,000 members, and since Stormfront started in 1995, there have been more than 2 million posts. Members live in all parts of the world, with close to 3,000 in and around South Carolina. Bob Whitaker is a former Reagan administration cabinet member and an active Stormfront member.
Oh, here we are. Stormfront Town Hall with Bob Whitaker.
He believes diversity and equal rights are at the center of a conspiracy against the white race.
I am worried about the disappearance of the white race.
Whitaker says too much is being done to diversify America, and not enough is being done to protect people like him.
I'm worried about two things. I'm worried about the disappearance of the white race, and I'm worried about the fact that no one is allowed to talk about the disappearance of the white race, which is even worse.
But all Americans are provided equal protection under the law, and that means equal treatment regardless of race, religion, sex, or national origin.
Jamie Kelso is one of Stormfront's senior moderators. He uses the screen name Charles A. Lindbergh, a well-known aviator who believed in the preservation of the white race.
I admire Charles Lindbergh as someone who, throughout his life, took pride in the white race and was very concerned about preserving it.
And even though Stormfront was created by former Ku Klux Klansman Don Black, Kelso says their message isn't one of hate.
We're called anti-Semitic, we're called neo-Nazi, and we're called racist. We're none of the three.
Instead, Stormfront members say their message is much more simple.
We don't hate anybody. The only thing we're concerned with is that 100 years from now, 500 years from now, that there actually be the kind of white neighborhoods, white nations that our parents and ancestors gave to us.
Kelso says Stormfront simply provides a safe forum.
As we celebrate the holidays, let's hope for less stormy times in America. Peaceful times. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. TalkNation.org for transcripts and further discussion. WHUS.org to listen live, Wednesdays at 5 p.m.